Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. This week will mark the second anniversary of the Great Shutdown, which occurred in early 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Many lives have been upended by COVID-19, both directly and indirectly, and it's safe to say that collectively our anxiety has only risen as the science, the rules, and the outcomes continually change. My guest today is a multimedia journalist with Oklahoma Watch, a nonprofit news source that works in the public interest. Whitney Bryan has been with Oklahoma Watch for 4 years, and most recently has been on the mental health and vulnerable population beat, writing compelling stories about our struggles with mental health access, resources, and the increase in need, reported mental health disorders, and unfortunately, new highs in suicide. If you or a loved one need help, you can always call 211 or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. Whitney Bryan grew up in the state and graduated from OU's Gaylord College of Journalism. She's held a number of positions in the field, and her work is an exemplar of clear and compelling work in the public interest and our health-related challenges. Journalist Whitney Bryan is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Whitney Bryan, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd love to start by just having you. You've been on this beat covering mental health for a while now. I'd love you to give kind of your assessment of mental health in Oklahoma as we're, you know, we finished almost 2 years now fully in the COVID-19 pandemic. And you've written some really interesting stories, but how would you kind of describe at a high level what's going on in mental health in Oklahoma, given the platform?
Yeah, John, I would say from my experience, I actually started reporting on mental health before the pandemic. I was working on a story with State Impact Oklahoma about mental health and policing. Why do police respond to people who are in mental health crisis? What does that look like? How is it working, et cetera? And I started that reporting back in 2019. And as I continued that reporting into 2020, that piece turned into a broader series, which then turned into a lot of reporting on other mental health related topics as we started seeing, you know, so many impacts from the pandemic in 2020 and beyond. You know, I saw issues with increased domestic violence and child abuse in the home from the pandemic. We saw isolation, you know, really people being impacted by isolation and being stuck at home, not having access to their support systems. We saw a lot of fear affecting people, the unknown of the virus and how scary it was for a lot of folks really was a trigger for folks who either already struggled with mental health or in some cases brought on new mental health challenges for folks who maybe weren't previously experiencing that. We've seen an increase in suicides here in Oklahoma over the past several years, and certainly the pandemic did not help with that. So I think dire is not an extreme word to use to describe the state of mental health in Oklahoma and frankly across the country. But as we've seen through national statistics, Oklahoma is one of the worst off states when it comes to things like depression, suicide, and access to care. So it's a tough situation here in the state, and there's certainly not a shortage of things to report on.
Well, yeah, you reported that there were over 800, in fact, almost 900 suicides, 900 people in Oklahoma took their own life in 2021, which was the highest number since 2006. But that 2006 was the year they first started sort of recording this data in an online fashion, I guess, or the way it's sort of reported out now. What were some of the things that you've identified, many of them, but what do you attribute a lot of that to? Just the lack of mental health services and availability for people and, you know, the pandemic, you know, increasing exacerbations of some chronic mental illnesses?
Absolutely. All of what you said is part of that. Those 883 Oklahomans who died by suicide in 2020, you know, we can never know for sure what led to that for those folks. But looking at the statistics, talking to the experts, we do know a few things. First of all, the pandemic absolutely had an impact on people's mental health and causing people to feel hopeless, making access to care more challenging. You know, with isolation and stay-at-home orders and restrictions that are meant to keep us physically safe, a lot of people faced mental health challenges due to those things. And certainly people who were in crisis having a hard time gaining access to mental health professionals, maybe because the facility where they work is shut down and is only taking telehealth appointments, maybe because the person who's in crisis is afraid to leave their home. You know, there's a million scenarios here. Regardless, the pandemic absolutely had an effect on these folks. And, you know, a few things we saw in the numbers, I looked at 5 years specifically of basically every single recorded suicide in the state of Oklahoma for those 5 years. There were thousands of them. And a few things that stuck out to me, first of all, Oklahomans who have died by suicide increased 62% since 2006. As you said, that's when the reports started coming in online in the same fashion that they do now. 62% increase in that time, which was obviously a shocking jump for us to look at. We also saw that Black Oklahomans, their suicide rates doubled from 2016 to 2020. In a four-year period, we saw twice as many Black Oklahomans die by suicide. And suicide rates are highest in rural Oklahoma, where that access to care that we've been talking about is the most scarce, even pre-pandemic. Of course, there are fewer mental health centers. It's harder for people in those areas to get to them. You might have an hour or 2 hour drive to the closest available clinician in those areas. Instead of, you know, in Oklahoma City, you might be 30 minutes away max to the closest provider. So those three points really stood out to me in that research and really showed us where Oklahomans are hurting the most.
Yeah. And so your reporting led you, you mentioned rural areas, to reporting on schools in some rural districts where educators that you interviewed identified mental health for students at, you know, young kids at these rural schools as low as it's ever been. And there's such a paucity really of mental health professionals, even though I think you wrote 35% of districts across the state have applied for pandemic related funding to try to boost their cadre of mental health professionals, but there just simply aren't enough to go around. Can you shed some light on what it's like for rural school districts?
Absolutely. You know, one statistic that really stood out to me in all of this reporting and continues to is I went out to Elk City. That was one of the school districts that I visited for that story. And in my research prior to visiting Elk City, I found out that for every 150,000 residents in Western Oklahoma, for every 150,000 people who live in Western Oklahoma, there is one mental health care provider. So we just talked about access in rural areas, and I think that's really the epitome of that struggle. Even if all of those people, all of those 150,000 people who live in an area in Western Oklahoma were aware that they were struggling with something and were willing to go and get help for it, could afford help for it, knew where to find help for it, even if all of those things were working in their favor, there's one clinician out there to serve 150,000 people. And that's just not manageable. That's not access to good mental health care for people in rural parts of the state. And schools then become the default for treating kids who are suffering with mental health struggles. So when you don't have, you know, certified providers outside of the school setting, well, that's where kids are, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. That's where they spend the majority of their time. So naturally, schools are going to become the default care provider for these kids. The problem with that is that teachers, educators, administrators, even school counselors are not trained mental health professionals. That is a completely different type of training that, say, a certified LPC or a licensed professional counselor receives. So you have educators who are learning to be teachers who have now become sort of the default mental health care provider for kids, especially in rural parts of the state. So there are, as you mentioned, a lot of school districts around the state who have received funding to try to increase the number of school counselors and specifically certified school counselors, so people who do have that extra layer of training. But ultimately, there just are not enough people to serve children and adults in the state. So we've put in some new, there was some new legislation last year, for instance, that requires all educators to take suicide prevention training. So this was the first school year where educators across the state were required to do that. So we are taking some steps in the right direction to help people in our schools better help kids who need it. But we're definitely not there. And educators and school counselors are certainly not a substitute for trained mental health professionals.
And Whitney, you mentioned earlier CIT training, that stands for crisis intervention training, that some police forces, in particular, in this case, in one of your stories, Oklahoma City, had trained police officers and had other professionals who are involved with these crisis intervention teams. And I guess they're getting used because I guess you reported that something like 20,000 calls go out per year. And so police wind up in de facto becoming, because we have such a shortage of mental health professionals, they wind up responding as first responders to a number of mental health calls or incidents, which isn't always ideal, let's just say. But of course, having specialized training for them can go a long way toward de-escalation in certain situations. What have you found about these crisis intervention teams and training? Would you consider at this point a success, and should it be expanded?
That's a great question, John. In fact, that's a question that our legislature, as well as mental health professionals and police captains all over the state, all over the nation, really have been grappling with over the last several years. There was a bill last year here in Oklahoma that would have required all police officers, all law enforcement across the entire state to take this CIT training, crisis intervention training. It did not pass last year. In fact, I don't believe it made it out of committee, if I'm remembering correctly. But I know that's something that has been proposed. It's continually being discussed. So that's something we might see in the future, but we haven't gotten there quite yet. So one issue that people have with this is we currently see police departments, rural and urban police departments across the state responding to people who may be experiencing a mental health crisis. So an example of that is someone might call in who is suicidal. They might call 911 and say, I'm suicidal. You know, I have a gun and I'm thinking about using it, and talk to a law enforcement dispatcher. Well, that dispatcher may end up sending a police officer to the scene to where that person is calling from because there is a weapon involved. It's labeled as sort of a violent situation, right? And police are trained to be, law enforcement training is all about public safety, right? It's about keeping the public safe. So in a case where someone might be suicidal and there's a weapon involved, maybe a gun in the house or something like that, you know, it makes sense to the police department that they're the ones that need to respond. However, mental health professionals might say, well, wait a minute, that person who is suicidal needs a mental health professional to step in that case, not a police officer. Police officers are not naturally trained, you know, through CLEAT training, through police academies, to de-escalate a situation like someone who might be suicidal, for instance. They're trained to protect the public. And so CIT training in some ways actually conflicts with what they're trained to do at CLEAT. So that's one of the big conflicts that we hear a lot between people who think that all police officers should be trained in CIT and people who say, no, that's not what police officers are charged with doing. We need someone else to step in those situations and take care of people who are experiencing a mental health crisis. There's been a lot of discussion around this topic in recent years. And in fact, Oklahoma City right now is developing a new program. It was supposed to launch in January, in fact, and I just checked in last week to find out how that was going. So hopefully we'll have an update on that soon. but they just developed a new program where police officers would be responding to these situations with a mental health professional. So they would kind of tag team those situations, show up to the scene together so that the mental health professional could be the one directly addressing the person who's in crisis and working with them on that level. But the police officer would also be on site to protect the clinician and the general public if there was any sort of, you know, safety concerns around public safety in that situation. So that's something that's being tried here in Oklahoma City now. I believe Tulsa already has a program where police officers, first responders, and mental health clinicians are responding together to some of these situations. So there are a lot of experiments going on that incorporate this CIT-trained officer into a situation. And then, of course, we still have scenarios all over the state, including in Tulsa and Oklahoma City, where we have those alternative programs where sometimes a police officer or multiple police officers arrive on a scene without any backup from mental health professionals. That's really where the CIT crisis intervention training comes into play, so that they have a better idea what the person might be thinking and feeling and have some ideas about how they might respond that, again, you know, might conflict a little bit with their police training, but end up being better for the person who's experiencing a mental health crisis.
Yeah. And one of the pieces you wrote about a guy named Benny Edwards, who was shot by two police officers for, I guess, you know, odd behavior or acting out. And you pointed out that neither of those officers had had crisis intervention training. And in fact, you go on to report that like fewer than 10%, I guess, of police officers across the state have been trained in crisis intervention. But as you point out, there are some efforts to grow this number. Interestingly, the police officers that do go through it do get a bump in their pay because it is an added responsibility and, of course, additional training. So that may be maybe a bit of good news. Whitney, I want to pivot for a second to something that you've also done. Toward the end of last year, 2021, you put online a call for a survey to assess willing Oklahomans who want to talk about their mental health openly. And there's a survey online. I was wondering if you could share with us kind of your goals in putting out the survey, and if people are interested, how they could respond, or perhaps what you've found so far.
Absolutely. Well, I put the survey out very end of last year, maybe first of this year. I can't remember the date now. It was during that window, I think, where we all lose track of dates with the holidays and all of that coming up. But my goal in putting the survey out was really to gauge how Oklahoma is doing in terms of mental health. You know, a lot of the information I get might seem a little more dire than it actually is, because I'm focused on what's going wrong. That's what I'm looking for as someone who's reporting on mental health here in Oklahoma. What are the problems? What are we missing? Who's falling through the gaps? And so sometimes, you know, I need to take a step back and say, okay, what are we doing right, though? What is working, and how are people getting help? And are most people really struggling, or are people starting to feel better now that, you know, the pandemic is sort of becoming a little bit more normal for people? Masks are something we're all using and are aware of, and it's just kind of becoming part of our lives now. And so this survey was really all about gauging what Oklahomans who are struggling with mental health are experiencing, or those who are caring for someone who's struggling with mental health, whether that be, you know, a family member or a mental health professional who maybe treats people. So it's a pretty wide variety of folks that we were hoping to hear from, and a wide variety of folks who have actually responded to the survey. We've gotten over 120 responses so far in the first 2 months of the year, which is fantastic. And we've heard from people who are in rural Oklahoma and wrote in about their struggle as an LGBT person in rural parts of the state where they don't feel understood. We're hearing from parents who are caring for teenagers who are struggling with their mental health. We've seen a lot of statistics over the last 2 years since the pandemic about teens especially really struggling from the pandemic, really feeling the effects of poor mental health from all of that. And so I'm hearing from parents. One woman wrote in, I'm looking at my responses now, and one of the questions was, how has the pandemic impacted your mental health? And she wrote that I'm an adult, so I have skills to cope, but my children have suffered immensely. I'm always worried about them, and we have to increase mental health therapies for all kids during the pandemic. So in her case, you know, she felt like she was equipped to handle even something as unexpected, something as new and chaotic as the pandemic was, but her children had a much more difficult time adapting. And I'm seeing that a lot in these responses. I had another person write in about the pandemic, a mother, and she also wrote, it's become harder to find help for my children who need mental health care than it was before the pandemic. Anxiety and stress has skyrocketed. So more people are seeking help, and it's making it more difficult than to find access to help. So a lot of people really struggling and writing in about their struggles. We're also hearing from people in classrooms who are saying, it's really hard to teach right now because kids are struggling with their mental health. And when they are concerned about the pandemic, when they're afraid, when they're not sleeping well, when they're anxious, it's really hard to teach math to those kids. So we've heard a lot from people, and it's really helping me to better understand what's happening around our state in terms of mental health and to shape my coverage. I'm reaching out to several of the folks who have submitted to the form already on our website. We will continue to leave that form open so that you, Oklahoma, can talk to us about your concerns, what's working for you and what isn't, and how you're feeling. And if you want to fill out that survey, answer some questions, or just tell us what you think we should know about mental health, you can head over to our website, oklahomawatch.org, scroll down just a little ways, and you'll see a link to our survey that you can fill out online. We would love to hear from you.
Okay, I was going to ask you where you could find it, so that's really helpful. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Oklahoma Watch journalist who covers mental health and, in fact, the vulnerability beat, we're calling it. Her name is Whitney Bryan. And Whitney, you've been with Oklahoma Watch, I think you said, on or around 4 years. Tell our listeners, remind our listeners what Oklahoma Watch is and kind of what you do there.
Sure. Well, I have been with Oklahoma Watch, as you said, for about 4 years now. Oklahoma Watch is a nonprofit news website. So that means that all of our funding comes from grants and donations. And our mission as a nonprofit news website is to serve the public. Everything that we do is about serving the public interest. So we're able to take a little bit of a deeper dive into stories about things like mental health. I've also covered, of course, the pandemic. I spent a lot of time writing about nursing homes during the pandemic and during COVID. I've spent some time writing about domestic violence and child abuse and many other sad and unhappy things. But ultimately, our goal is to serve you, the listeners. Similar to Public Radio Tulsa, we are here for you. We want to know what you need from us. So as part of our mission, we provide all of our content that we post on our website to other publications around the state as well. So a lot of people might see my stories in, you know, the Tulsa World, for instance, or the Oklahoman or other newspapers. I've gone on OETA and talked to them about my reporting as well. So you can find us pretty much anywhere, and hopefully we're achieving those public service goals. But if we're not, certainly we want to hear from you. What are we missing, and what else do you need from us?
And tell us a little bit about your own background. I mean, your Twitter handle, I note, is @SoonerReporter. So I think there's a deep tie to Oklahoma there. Did you grow up here and attend school here?
Absolutely. Yes, I was born and raised here in Oklahoma. I am an Okie through and through. I grew up in Edmond, went to school there, K through 12, and then went to journalism school at OU and graduated from there. I actually moved out of the state for a few years after I graduated from OU to take a job at a newspaper in Colorado. And I worked there for several years and then came back to Oklahoma about 4 or 5 years ago now, and have been working mostly with Oklahoma Watch since that time.
In your career, have you seen things change? Like, for example, I note that you're not only, I mean, you describe it as web-based, so in some ways you're writing stories, but you're also taking the photographs, and I think you mentioned that you do some of the videography as well. So you're more of a multimedia journalist, but are more and more, say, journalism grads at a school like OU like the Gaylord School of Journalism there are having to sort of do it all or be jacks of many trades. It's less of a, you have to be able to do more because the jobs are sort of fewer and farther between. Is that sort of a truism these days?
Absolutely. That was a truism when I was going through the program close to 10 years ago now, about 10 years ago now. It's been a while. But even more so, I think now. And unfortunately, I think a lot of that, while some of that does revolve around the web, you know, just the increase of, you know, journalism online, unfortunately, I think a lot of it also falls to journalists who are, to publications who are short-staffed. So we don't have the, you know, the money and the capability and the staff to hire amazing photographers and photojournalists and photo editors like we once did in the industry, which is extremely unfortunate. I know some fantastic photojournalists, and I think that work is so important. But unfortunately, that's just the situation in the industry right now for a lot of folks. And so at Oklahoma Watch, as well as most other publications around the state now, we are doing a little bit of everything. At Oklahoma Watch, our journalists are taking a lot of their own photos. We're using smartphones a lot of the time to take photos from meetings that we're attending and of sources that we're talking to. But I'm also lucky to work for a nonprofit. So, you know, we get to do things a little bit differently because we are being funded by the public. And so my position at Oklahoma Watch is pretty unique in that I am a multimedia journalist, and I take a lot of photos for other stories, not just my own. I also take a lot of video footage and create a lot of videos for our website. And we use a lot of, you know, data journalism as well. So we're pretty well versed in creating charts and interactive graphics and ways for you to visualize that data. So we sort of jack of all trades, I think is what you called it. And that's certainly what we hope to be at Oklahoma Watch.
It's just so interesting because we live in such an era of like uber specialization, or, you know, in different careers and professions where people have to really like sub-specialize in specific things. And yet in journalism, you have to do, it seems like, much more of it because of the sort of changes to the industry. Well, Whitney, Brian, I really want to thank you and Oklahoma Watch for doing such important work, as you point out, in the public interest, and your work in particular on vulnerability, talking about really important issues that don't get a lot of attention, you know, specifically around mental health, but as you mentioned, domestic violence, child abuse, things that are unfortunate realities in our society but have only been exacerbated by the pandemic as fewer people have come into contact with authorities. I really appreciate you taking the time. Whitney Bryan is a mental health and vulnerability multimedia journalist with Oklahoma Watch. And as she stated, you can learn more about them, see her reporting and many other great stories and resources on their website, oklahomawatch.org. Whitney Bryan, thank you so much for joining us.
John, thank you for having me.
Whitney Bryan is a multimedia journalist covering mental health and vulnerable populations for Oklahoma Watch. You can learn more about her work and Oklahoma Watch at their website, oklahomawatch.org. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.